Two, the accordion. It sat in its case under her bed. Every so often she took it out, throwing the strap over her shoulders to keep the huge, many-keyed, wheezing instrument off the ground. The accordion seemed nearly as big as she was, and she played it dutifully, badly, and always with the suggestion of a carnival sadness. As little children, Milton and Tessie had shared the same bedroom and bathtub, but that was long ago. Up until recently, Milton thought of Tessie as his prim cousin. Whenever one of his friends expressed interest in her, Milton told them to give up the idea. "That's honey from the icebox," he said, as Artie Shaw might have. "Cold sweets don't spread." And then one day, Milton came home with some new reeds from the music store. He hung his coat and hat on the pegs in the foyer, took out the reeds, and balled the paper bag up in his fist. Stepping into the living room, he took a set shot. The paper sailed across the room, hit the rim of the trash can, and bounced out, at which point a voice said, "You better stick to music." Milton looked to see who it was. He saw who it was. But who it was no longer who it had been. Theodora was lying on the couch, reading. She had on a spring dress, a pattern of red flowers. Her feet were bare, and that was when Milton saw them, the red toenails. Milton had never suspected that Theodora was the kind of girl who would paint her toenails. The red nails made her look womanly, while the rest of her, the thin, pale arms, the fragile neck, remained as girlish as always. "I'm watching the roast," she explained. "Where's my mom?" "She went out." "She went out? She never goes out." "She did today." "Where's my sister?" 4-H. Tessie looked at the black case he was holding. "That's your clarinet?"
"Yeah."
"Play something for me." Milton set his instrument case down on the sofa. As he opened it and took out his clarinet, he remained aware of the nakedness of Tessie's legs. He inserted the mouthpiece and limbered up his fingers, running them up and down the keys. And then, at the mercy of an overwhelming impulse, he bent forward, pressing the flaring end of the clarinet to Tessie's bare knee, and blew a long note. She squealed, moving her knee away. "That was a D-flat," Milton said. "You want to hear a D-sharp?" Tessie still had her hand over her buzzing knee. The vibration of the clarinet had sent a shiver all the way up her thigh. She felt funny, as though she were about to laugh, but she didn't laugh. She was staring at her cousin, thinking, "Will you just look at him smiling away? Still got pimples, but thinks he's the cat's meow. Where does he get it?" "All right," she answered at last. "Okay," said Milton. "D sharp. Here goes." That first day, it was Tessie's knees. The following Sunday, Milton came up from behind and played his clarinet against the back of Tessie's neck. The sound was muffled. Wisps of her hair flew up. Tessie screamed, but not long. "Yeah, Dad," said Milton, standing behind her. And so it began. He played Begin the Beguine against Tessie's collarbone. He played Moonface against her smooth cheeks, pressing the clarinet right up against the red toenails that so dazzled him. He played It Goes to Your Feet. With a secrecy they didn't acknowledge, Milton and Tessie drifted off to quiet parts of the house, and there, lifting her skirt a little, or removing a sock, or once, when nobody was home, pulling up her blouse to expose her lower back, Tessie allowed Milton to press his clarinet to her skin and fill her body with music. At first it only tickled her, but after a while the notes spread deeper into her body. She felt the vibrations penetrate her muscles, pulsing in waves until they rattled her bones and made her inner organs hum. Milton played his instrument with the same fingers he used for the Boy Scout salute, but his thoughts were anything but wholesome. Breathing hard, bent over Tessie with trembling concentration, he moved the clarinet in circles like a snake charmer, and Tessie was a cobra, mesmerized, tamed, ravished by the sound. Finally, one afternoon when they were all alone, Tessie, his proper cousin, lay down on her back. She crossed one arm over her face. "Where should I play?" whispered Milton, his mouth feeling too dry to play anything. Tessie undid a button on her blouse and in a strangled voice said, "My stomach." "I don't know a song about a stomach," Milton ventured. "My ribs, then." "I don't know any songs about ribs."
"My sternum?"
"Nobody ever wrote a song about a sternum, Tess." She undid more buttons, her eyes closed, and in barely a whisper, "How about this?" "That one I know," said Milton. When he couldn't play against Tessie's skin, Milton opened the window of his bedroom and serenaded her from afar. Sometimes he called the boarding house and asked Mrs. O'Toole if he could speak with Theodora. "Minute," Mrs. O'Toole said and shouted up the stairs. "Phone for Zizmo!" Milton heard the sound of feet running down the stairs and then Tessie's voice saying hello, and he began playing his clarinet into the phone. Years later, my mother would recall the days when she was wooed by clarinet. "Your father couldn't play very well. Two or three songs, that was it."
"What do you mean?" Milton would protest. "I had a whole repertoire."
He'd begin to whistle, "Begin the Beguine," warbling the melody to evoke a clarinet's vibrato and fingering the air. "Why don't you serenade me anymore?" Tessie would ask. But Milton had something else on his mind.
"Whatever happened to that old clarinet of mine?" And then Tessie.
"How should I know? You expect me to keep track of everything?
Is it down in the basement?"
"Maybe I threw it out."
"You threw it out? What the hell did you do that for?"
"What are you going to do, Milt? Practice up? You couldn't play the darn thing back then." All love serenades must come to an end. But in 1944... there was no stop to the music. By July, when the telephone rang at the O'Toole boarding house, there was sometimes another kind of love song issuing from the earpiece.
"Kyrie eleison, Kyrie eleison."
A soft voice, nearly as feminine as Tessie's own, cooing into a phone a few blocks away. The singing continued for a minute at least, and then Michael Antoniou would ask, "How was that?"
"That was swell," my mother said.
"It was? Just like in church. You could have fooled me." Which brings me to the final complication in that overplotted year. Worried about what Milton and Tessie were getting up to, my grandmother wasn't only trying to marry Milton off to somebody else. By that summer, she had a husband picked out for Tessie, too. Michael Antoniou. Father Mike, as he would come to be known in our family, was at that time a seminarian at the Greek Orthodox Holy Cross Theological School out in Pomfret, Connecticut. Back home for the summer, he had been paying a lot of attention to Tessie Zizmo. In 1933, Assumption Church had moved out of its quarters in the storefront on Hart Street. Now the congregation had a real church on Verner Highway just off Beneteau. The church was made of yellow brick. It wore three dove-gray domes like caps and had a basement for socializing. During coffee hour, Michael Antoniou told Tessie what it was like out at Holy Cross and educated her about the lesser-known aspects of Greek Orthodoxy. He told her about the monks of Mount Athos, who in their zeal for purity banned not only women from their island monastery, but the females of every other species too. There were no female birds on Mount Athos, no female snakes, no female dogs or cats. "A little too strict for me," Michael Antoniou said, smiling meaningfully at Tessie. "I just want to be a parish priest, married, with kids." My mother wasn't surprised that he showed interest in her. Being short herself, she was used to short guys asking her to dance. She didn't like being chosen by virtue of her height, but Michael Antoniou was persistent. And he might not have been pursuing her because she was the only girl shorter than he was. He might have been responding to the need in Tessie's eyes, her desperate yearning to believe that there was something instead of nothing. Desdemona seized her opportunity.
"Mikey," he is good Greek boy, nice boy, she said to Tessie, and going to be a priest. And to Michael Antoniou, Tessie, he is small, but she is strong. How many plates you think she can carry, Father Mike?
I'm not a father yet, Mrs. Stephanides.
Please, how many?
Six?
That all you think? Six? And now holding up two hands, ten plates Tessie can carry, never break a thing.
She began inviting Michael Antoniou over for Sunday dinner. The presence of the seminarian inhibited Tessie, who no longer wandered upstairs for private swing sessions. Milton, growing surly at this new development, threw barbs across the dinner table.
I guess it must be a lot harder to be a priest over here in America, huh?
How do you mean?
Michael Antoniou asked.
I just mean that over in the old country, people aren't too well educated, Milton said. They'll believe whatever stories the priests tell them. Here it's different. You can go to college and learn to think for yourself.
The church doesn't want people not to think, Michael replied without taking offense. The church believes that thinking will take a person only so far. Where thinking ends, revelation begins.
Chrysostomos, Desdemona exclaimed. Father Mike, you have a mouth of gold.
But Milton persisted.
I'd say where thinking ends, stupidity begins.
That's how people live, Milt, Michael Antoniou again, still kindly, gently, by telling stories. What's the first thing a kid says when he learns how to talk?
Tell me a story. That's how we understand who we are, where we come from. Stories are everything. And what story does the church have to tell? That's easy. It's the greatest story ever told.
My mother, listening to this debate, couldn't fail to notice the stark contrast between her two suitors. On one side, faith. On the other, skepticism. On one side, kindness. On the other, hostility. An admittedly short, though pleasant-looking young man against a scrawny, pimply 4F boy with circles under his eyes like a hungry wolf. Michael Antoniou hadn't so much as tried to kiss Tessie, whereas Milton had led her astray with a woodwind, D-flats and A-sharps licking at her like so many tongues of flame, here behind the knee, up here on the neck, right below the navel. The inventory filled her with shame. Later that afternoon, Milton cornered her. I got a new song for you, Tess. Just learned it today. But Tessie told him, get away.
Why? What's the matter?
It's... She tried to think of the most damning pronouncement. It's not nice.
That's not what you said last week. Milton waved the clarinet, adjusting the reed with a wink until Tessie finally...
I don't want to do that anymore. Do you understand? Leave me alone.
Every Saturday for the remainder of the summer, Michael Antoniou came by O'Toole's to pick Tessie up. Taking her purse as they walked along, he swung it by its strap, pretending it was a censer.
You have to do it just right, he told her. If you don't swing it hard enough, the chain buckles and the embers fall out.
On the way down the street, my mother tried to ignore her embarrassment at being seen in public with a man swinging a purse. At the drugstore soda fountain, she watched him tuck a napkin into his shirt collar before eating his sundae. Instead of popping the cherry into his mouth, as Milton would have done, Michael Antoniou always offered it to her. Later, seeing her home, he squeezed her hand and looked sincerely into her eyes.
Thank you for another enjoyable afternoon. See you in church tomorrow.
Then he walked away, folding his hands behind his back, practicing how to walk like a priest, too. After he was gone, Tessie went inside and climbed the stairs to her room. She lay down on her daybed to read. One afternoon, unable to concentrate, she stopped reading and put the book over her face. Just then, outside, a clarinet began to play. Tessie listened for a while, without moving. Finally, her hand rose to take the book off her face. It never got there, however. The hand waved in the air, as if conducting the music, and then, sensibly, resignedly, desperately, it slammed the window shut.
Bravo!
Desdemona shouted into the phone a few days later, then holding the mouthpiece to her chest.
Mikey Antonio just proposed to Tessie. They're engaged. They are going to get married as soon as Mikey, he finishes the seminary.
Don't look too excited, Zoe told her brother. Why don't you shut up? Don't get sore at me, she said, blind to the future. I'm not marrying him. You'd have to shoot me first.
She wants to marry a priest, Milton said. Let her marry a priest. Hell with her.
His face turned red and he bolted from the table and fled up the stairs. But why did my mother do it? She could never explain. The reasons people marry the people they do are not always evident to those involved. So I can only speculate. Maybe my mother, having grown up without a father, was trying to marry one. It's possible, too, that her decision was a practical one. She'd asked Milton what he wanted to do with his life once. I was thinking of maybe taking over my dad's bar. On top of all the other oppositions, there may have been this final one. Bartender, priest. Impossible to imagine my father weeping from a broken heart. Impossible to imagine him refusing to eat. Impossible also to imagine him calling the boarding house again and again until finally Mrs. O'Toole said, "Listen, sugar, she don't want to talk to you. Get it?"
"Yeah," Milton, swallowing hard. "I got it.
Plenty of other fish in the sea."
Impossible to imagine any of these things. But they are, in fact, what happened. Maybe Mrs. O'Toole's maritime metaphor had given him an idea. A week after Tessie became engaged on a steamy Tuesday morning, Milton put his clarinet away for good and went down to Cadillac Square to exchange his Boy Scout uniform for another.
"Well, I did it," he told the family at dinner that night. "I enlisted."
"In the army?" Desdemona said, horrified. "What did you do that for?" said Zoe. "The war's almost over. Hitler's finished."
"I don't know about Hitler. It's Hirohito I've got to worry about. I joined the Navy, not the Army."
"What about your feet?" Desdemona cried.
"They didn't ask about my feet."
My grandfather, who had sat through the clarinet serenades, as he sat through everything, aware of their significance but unconvinced of the wisdom of getting involved, now glared at his son.
"You're a very stupid young man, do you know that? You think this is some kind of game?"
"No, sir."
"This is a war. You think it is some kind of fun? A war? Some kind of big joke to play on your parents?"
"No, sir."
"You will see what kind of big joke it is."
"The Navy," Desdemona meanwhile continued to moan. "What if your boat sinks?"
"You see what you do," Lefty shook his head. "You're going to make your mother sick, worrying so much."
"I'll be okay," said Milton.
Looking at his son, Lefty now saw a painful sight. Himself, 20 years earlier, full of stupid, cocky optimism. There was nothing to do with the spike of fear that shot through him, but to speak out in anger.
"Okay, then. Go to the Navy," said Lefty. "But you know what you forgot, Mr. Almost Eagle Scout?" He pointed at Milton's chest. "You forgot. You'll never win a badge for swimming."
News of the World. I waited 3 days before calling Julie again. It was 10 o'clock at night, and she was still in her studio working. She hadn't eaten, so I suggested we get something. I said I'd come by and pick her up. This time, she let me in. Her studio was a mess, frightening in its chaos. But after the first few steps, I forgot about all that. My attention was arrested by what I saw on the walls. 5 or 6 large test prints were tacked up, each one showing the industrial landscape of a chemical plant. Julie had shot the factory from a crane so that the effect for the viewer was of floating just above the snaking pipes and smokestacks.
"Okay, that's enough," she said, pushing me toward the door. "Hold on," I said. "I love factories. I'm from Detroit. This is like an Ansel Adams for me."
"Now you've seen it," she said, shooing me out, pleased, uncomfortable, smiling, stubborn.
I've got a Berndenhiller Becker in my living room, I boasted.
You've got a Berndenhiller Becker?
She stopped pushing me. It's an old cement factory.
Okay, all right, said Julie, relenting.
I do factories. That's what I do. Factories. These are the I.G. Farben plant. She winced. I worried. It's the typical thing for an American to do over here.
Holocaust industry, you mean?
I haven't read that book, but yeah.
If you've always done factories, I think it's different, I told her. Then you're not just glomming on. If factories are your subject, how could you not do I.G. Farben?
You think it's okay?
I pointed to the test prints.
These are great. We fell silent, looking at each other, and without thinking, I leaned forward and kissed Julie lightly on the lips. When the kiss was over, she opened her eyes very wide.
I thought you were gay when we met, she said.
Must have been the suit.
My gaydar went off completely. Julie was shaking her head. I'm always suspicious, being the last stop.
The last what?
Oh, haven't you heard of that? Asian chicks are the last stop. If a guy's in the closet, he goes for an Asian because their bodies are more like boys.
Your body's not like a boy's, I said. This embarrassed Julie. She looked away.
You've had a lot of closeted gay guys go after you, I asked her.
Twice in college, 3 times in graduate school, answered Julie. There was no other response to this but to kiss her again.
To resume my parents' story, I need to bring up a very embarrassing memory for a Greek-American. Michael Dukakis on his tank. Do you remember that? The single image that doomed our hopes of getting a Greek into the White House. Dukakis, wearing an oversized army helmet, bouncing along on top of an M41 Walker Bulldog, trying to look presidential, but looking instead like a little boy on an amusement park ride. Every time a Greek gets near the Oval Office, something goes wrong. First it was Agnew with the tax evasion, then it was Dukakis with the tank. Before Dukakis climbed up on that armored vehicle, before he took off his J-Press suit and put on those army fatigues, we all felt, I speak for my fellow Greek-Americans, whether they want me to or not, a sense of exultation. This man was the Democratic nominee for President of the United States. He was from Massachusetts, like the Kennedys. He practiced a religion even stranger than Catholicism, but no one was bringing it up. This was 1988. Maybe the time had finally come when anyone, or at least not the same old someones, could be president. Behold the banners at the Democratic Convention. Look at the bumper stickers on all the Volvos. Dukakis, a name with more than 2 vowels in it, running for president. The last time that had happened was Eisenhower, who looked good on a tank. Generally speaking, Americans like their presidents to have no more than 2 vowels. Truman, Johnson, Nixon, Clinton. If they have more than 2 vowels, Reagan, they can have no more than 2 syllables. Even better is 1 syllable and 1 vowel. Bush. Had to do that twice. Why did Mario Cuomo decide against running for president? What conclusion did he come to as he withdrew to think the matter through? Unlike Michael Dukakis, who was from academic Massachusetts, Mario Cuomo was from New York and knew what was what. Cuomo knew he'd never win. Too liberal for the moment, certainly, but also too many vowels. On top of a tank, Michael Dukakis rode toward a bank of photographers and into the political sunset. Painful as the image is to recall, I bring it up for a reason. More than anything, that was what my newly enlisted father, Seaman Second Class Milton Stefanides, looked like as he bounced in a landing craft off the California coast in the fall of 1944. Like Dukakis, Milton was mostly helmet. Like Dukakis's, Milton's chin strap looked as though it had been fastened by his mother. Like Dukakis's, Milton's expression betrayed a creeping awareness of error. Milton, too, couldn't get off his moving vehicle. He, too, was riding toward extinction. The only difference was the absence of photographers, because it was in the middle of the night. A month after joining the United States Navy, Milton found himself stationed at Coronado Naval Base in San Diego. He was a member of the amphibious forces whose job it was to transport troops to the Far East and assist their storming of beaches. It was Milton's job
luckily so far only in maneuvers, to lower the landing craft off the side of the transport ship. For over a month, 6 days a week, 10 hours a day, that's what he'd been doing, lowering boats full of men into various sea conditions. When he wasn't lowering landing craft, he was in one himself. 3 or 4 nights a week, they had to practice night landings. These were extremely tricky. The coast around Coronado was treacherous. The inexperienced pilots had trouble steering toward the diff lights, which marked the beaches, and often brought the boats to shore on the rocks. Though the army helmet obscured Milton's present vision, it gave him a pretty good picture of the future. The helmet weighed as much as a bowling ball. It was as thick as the hood of a car. You put it over your head like a hat, but it was nothing like a hat. In contact with the skull, an army helmet transmitted images directly into the brain. These were of objects the helmet was designed to keep out. Bullets, for instance, and shrapnel. The helmets closed off the mind for contemplation of these essential realities. And if you were a person like my father, you began to think about how you could escape such realities. After a single week of drills, Milton realized that he had made a terrible mistake joining the Navy. Battle could be only slightly less dangerous than this preparation for it. Every night someone got injured. Waves slammed guys up against the boats. Guys fell and got swept underneath. The week before, a kid from Omaha had drowned. During the day, they trained playing football on the beach in army boots to build up their legs, and then at night they had the drills. Exhausted, seasick, Milton stood packed in like a sardine, shouldering a heavy pack. He had always wanted to be an American, and now he got to see what his fellow Americans were like. In close quarters, he suffered their backwoods lubricity and knucklehead talk. They were in the boats for hours together, getting slammed around, getting wet. They got to bed at 3 or 4 in the morning. Then the sun came up and it was time to do it all over again. Why had he joined the Navy? For revenge? For escape? He wanted to get back at Tessie. And he wanted to forget her. Neither had worked. The dullness of military life, the endless repetition of duties, the standing in line to eat, to use the bathroom, to shave, served as no distraction at all. Standing in line all day brought on the very thoughts Milton had wanted to avoid of a clarinet imprint, like a ring of fire on Tessie's flushed thigh. Or of Vandenbroek, the kid from Omaha who had drowned, his battered face, the seawater leaking through his busted teeth. All around Milton in the boat now, guys were already getting sick. 10 minutes in the swells, and sailors were bending over and regurgitating the beef stew and instant mashed potatoes of that evening's dinner onto the ridged metal floor. This provoked no comment. The vomit, which was an eerie blue color in the moonlight, had its own wave action sloshing back and forth over everybody's boots. Milton lifted his face, trying to get a whiff of fresh air. The boat pitched and rolled. It fell off waves and came crashing down, the hull shuddering. They were getting close to shore, where the surf picked up. The other men readjusted their packs and got ready for the make-believe assault, and Seaman Stefanides abandoned the solitude of his helmet. "Saw it in the library," the sailor beside him was saying to another. "On the bulletin board."
"What kind of test?"
"Some kind of admittance exam for Annapolis."
"Yeah, right. They're going to let a couple of guys like us into Annapolis?
Doesn't matter if they let us in or not. Deal is, whoever takes the test gets excused from drills."
"What'd you say about a test?" Milton asked, butting in. The sailor looked around to see if anyone else had heard.
"Keep quiet about it. If we all sign up, it won't work."
"When is it?"
But before the sailor could answer, there was a loud, grinding sound. They had hit the rocks again. The sudden stop knocked everyone forward. Helmets rang against one another. Noses broke. Sailors fell into a pile, and the front hatch fell away. Water was streaming into the boat now, and the lieutenant was yelling. Milton, along with everyone else, leapt into the confusion. The black rocks, the sucking undertow, the Mexican beer bottles, the startled crabs. Back in Detroit, also in the dark, my mother was at the movies. Michael Antoniou, her fiancé, had returned to Holy Cross, and now she had her Saturdays free. On the screen of the Esquire Theater, numerals flashed. 5, 4, 3, and a newsreel began. Muted trumpets blared. An announcer began giving war reports. It had been the same announcer throughout the war, so that by now Tessie felt she knew him. He was almost family. Week after week he had informed her about Monty and the Brits driving Rommel's tanks out of North Africa, and the American troops liberating Algeria and landing in Sicily. Munching popcorn, Tessie had watched as the months and years passed. The newsreels followed an itinerary. At first, they'd concentrated on Europe. There were tanks rolling through tiny villages and French girls waving handkerchiefs from balconies. The French girls didn't look like they'd been through a war. They wore pretty ruffled skirts, white ankle socks, and silk scarves. None of the men wore berets, which surprised Tessie. She'd always wanted to go to Europe, not to Greece so much, but to France or Italy. As she watched these newsreels, what Tessie noticed wasn't the bombed-out buildings, but the sidewalk cafes, the fountains, the self-composed urbane little dogs. Two Saturdays ago, she'd seen Antwerp and Brussels liberated by the Allies. Now, as attention turned toward Japan, the scenery was changing. Palm trees cropped up in the newsreels, and tropical islands. This afternoon, the screen gave the date October 1944, and the announcer announced, "As American troops prepare for the final invasion of the Pacific, General Douglas MacArthur, vowing to make good on his promise of 'I shall return,' surveys his troops." The footage showed sailors standing at attention on deck, or dropping artillery shells into guns, or horsing around on a beach waving to the folks back home. And out in the audience, my mother found herself doing a crazy thing. She was looking for Milton's face. He was her second cousin, wasn't he? It was only natural she should worry about him. They had also been, not in love exactly, but in something more immature, a kind of infatuation or crush. Nothing like what she had with Michael. Tessie sat up in her seat. She adjusted her purse in her lap. She sat up like a young lady who was engaged to be married. But after the newsreel ended and the movie began, she forgot about being an adult. She sank down in her seat and put her feet up over the seat in front. Maybe it wasn't a very good movie that day. Or maybe she'd seen too many movies lately. She'd gone for the last 8 straight days. But whatever the reason, Tessie couldn't concentrate. She kept thinking that if something happened to Milton, if he was wounded, or, God forbid, if he didn't come back, she would be somehow to blame. She hadn't told him to enlist in the Navy. If he'd asked her, she would have told him not to. But she knew he'd done it because of her. It was a little like Into the Sands with Claude Barron, which she'd seen a couple of weeks ago. In that picture, Claude Barron enlists in the Foreign Legion because Rita Carroll marries another guy. The other guy turns out to be a cheater and drinker, and so Rita Carroll leaves him and travels out to the desert where Claude Barron is fighting the Arabs. By the time Rita Carroll gets there, he's in the hospital wounded, or not a hospital really, but just a tent, and she tells him she loves him, and Claude Barron says, "I went into the desert to forget about you, but the sand was the color of your hair, the desert sky was the color of your eyes. There was nowhere I could go that wouldn't be you." And then he dies. Tessie cried buckets. Her mascara ran, staining the collar of her blouse, something awful. Drilling at night and going to Saturday matinees, jumping into the sea and sliding down in movie seats, worrying and regretting and hoping and trying to forget. Nevertheless, to be perfectly honest, mostly what people did during the war was write letters. In support of my personal belief that real life doesn't live up to writing about it, the members of my family seem to have spent most of their time that year engaged in correspondence. From Holy Cross, Michael Antonio wrote twice a week to his fiancée. His letters arrived in light blue envelopes embossed with the head of Patriarch Benjamin in the upper left-hand corner, and on the stationery inside, his handwriting, like his voice, was feminine and neat. "Most likely, the first place they'll send us after my ordination will be somewhere in Greece. There's going to be a lot of rebuilding to do now that the Nazis have left." At her desk beneath the Shakespeare bookends, Tessie wrote back faithfully, if not entirely truthfully. Most of her daily activities didn't seem virtuous enough to tell a seminarian fiancé, and so she began to invent a more appropriate life for herself. This morning, Zoe and I went down to volunteer at the Red Cross, wrote my mother, who had spent the entire day at the Fox Theater eating nonpareils. They had us cut up old bed sheets into strips for bandages. You should see the blister I've got on my thumb. It's a real whopper. She didn't start out with these wholesale fictions. At first, Tessie had given an honest accounting of her days, but in one letter, Michael Antonio had said, "Movies are fine as entertainment, but with the war, I wonder if they're the best way to spend your time." After that, Tessie started making things up. She rationalized her lying by telling herself that this was her last year of freedom. By next summer, she'd be a priest's wife, living somewhere in Greece. To mitigate her dishonesty, she deflected all honor from herself, filling her letters with praise for Zoe. She works 6 days a week, but on Sundays gets up bright and early to take Mrs. Tsonsakis to church. Poor thing's 93 and can barely walk. That's Zoe, always thinking of others. Meanwhile, Desdemona and Milton were writing to each other, too. Before going off to war, my father had promised his mother that he'd finally become literate in Greek. Now, from California, lying on his bunk in the evenings, so sore he could barely move, Milton consulted a Greek-English dictionary to piece together reports on his Navy life. No matter how hard he concentrated, however, by the time his letters arrived at Hurlbut Street, something had been lost in translation. "What kind of paper this is?" Desdemona asked her husband, holding up a letter that resembled Swiss cheese. Like mice, military censors had nibbled at Milton's letters before Desdemona got to digest them. They bit off any mention of the word invasion, any reference to San Diego or Coronado. They chewed through whole paragraphs describing the naval base, the destroyers and submarines docked at the pier. Since the censor's Greek was even worse than Milton's, they often made mistakes, lopping off endearments, X's and O's. Despite the gaps in Milton's missives, syntactical and physical, my grandmother registered the danger of his situation. In his badly penned sigmas and deltas, she spied the shaking hand of her son's growing anxiety. Over his grammatical mistakes, she detected the note of fear in his voice. The stationery itself frightened her, because it already looked blown to bits. Seaman Stefanides, however, was doing his best to prevent injury. On a Wednesday morning, he reported to the base library to take the admittance exam for the U.S. Naval Academy. Over the next 5 hours, every time he looked up from his test paper, he saw his shipmates doing calisthenics in the hot sun. He couldn't help smiling. While his buddies were baking out there, Milton was sitting under a ceiling fan, working out a mathematical proof. While they were forced to run up and down the sandy gridiron, Milton was reading a paragraph by someone named Carlyle and answering the questions that followed. And tonight, when they would be getting creamed against the rocks, he would be snug in his bunk, fast asleep. By the time the early months of 1945 rolled in, everyone was looking for exemptions from duty. My mother hid from charitable works by going to the movies. My father ducked maneuvers by taking a test. But when it came to exemptions, my grandmother sought one from nothing less than heaven itself. One Sunday in March, she arrived at Assumption before the divine liturgy had started. Going into a niche, she approached the icon of St. Christopher and proposed a deal. "Please, St. Christopher," Desdemona kissed her fingertips and touched them to the saint's forehead. "If you keep Milty safe in the war, I will make him promise to go back to Vithinios and fix the church." She looked up at St. Christopher, the martyr of Asia Minor. "If the Turks destroyed it, Milty will build it again. If it only needs painting, he'll paint." St. Christopher was a giant. He held a staff and forded a rushing river. On his back was the Christ child, the heaviest baby in history because he had the world in his hands. What better saint to protect your own son in peril on the sea? In the shadowy, lamp-lit space, Desdemona prayed. She moved her lips, spelling out the conditions. "I would also like, if possible, St. Christopher, if Milty, he could be excused from the training. He tells me it is very dangerous. He's writing to me in Greek now, too, St. Christopher. Not too good, but
Okay. I also make him promise to put in the church new pews. Also, if you like, some carpets.
She lapsed into silence, closing her eyelids. She crossed herself numerous times, waiting for an answer. Then, her spine suddenly straightened. She opened her eyes, nodded, smiled. She kissed her fingertips and touched them to the saint's picture, and she hurried home to write Milton the good news.
Yeah, sure, my father said when he got the letter. Saint Christopher to the rescue. He slipped the letter into his Greek-English dictionary and carried both to the incinerator behind the Quonset hut. That was the end of my father's Greek lessons. Though he continued to speak Greek to his parents, Milton never succeeded in writing it, and as he got older, he began to forget what even the simplest words meant. In the end, he couldn't say much more than chapter 11 or me, which was almost nothing at all. Milton's sarcasm was understandable under the circumstances. Only the day before, his CO had given Milton a new assignment in the upcoming invasion. The news, like all bad news, hadn't registered at first. It was as if the CO's words, the actual syllables he addressed to Milton, had been scrambled by the boys over in intelligence. Milton had saluted and walked out. He continued down to the beach, still unaffected, the bad news acting with a kind of discretion, allowing him these last few peaceful, deluded moments. He watched the sunset. He admired a neutral Switzerland of seals out on the rocks. He took off his boots to feel the sand against his feet, as if the world were a place he was only beginning to live in, instead of somewhere he would soon be leaving. But then the fissures appeared. A split in the top of his skull through which the bad news hissingly poured. A groove in his knees which buckled, and suddenly Milton couldn't keep it out any longer. 38 seconds. That was the news. Stephanides, we're switching you over to Signalman. Report to Building B at 0700 hours tomorrow morning. Dismissed. That was what the CO had said. Only that. And it was no surprise, really. As the invasion neared, there had been a sudden rash of injuries to signalmen. Signalmen had been chopping off fingers, doing KP duty. Signalmen had been shooting themselves in the feet while cleaning their guns. In the nighttime drills, signalmen lustily flung themselves onto the rocks. 38 seconds was the life expectancy of a signalman. When the landing took place, Seaman Stephanides would stand in the front of the boat. He would operate a sort of lantern, flashing signals in Morse code. This lantern would be bright, clearly visible to enemy positions on shore. That was what he was thinking about as he stood on the beach with his boots off. He was thinking that he would never take over his father's bar. He was thinking that he would never see Tessie again. Instead, a few weeks from now, he would stand up in a boat, exposed to hostile fire, holding a bright light. For a little while, at least. Not included in the news of the world. A shot of my father's AKA transport ship leaving Coronado Naval Base heading west. At the Esquire Theater, holding her feet off the sticky floor, Tessie Zismo watches as white arrows arc across the Pacific. The U.S. Naval 12th Fleet forges ahead on its invasion of the Pacific, the announcer says. Final destination, Japan. One arrow starts out in Australia, moving through New Guinea toward the Philippines. Another arrow shoots out from the Solomon Islands, and another from the Marianas. Tessie has never heard of these places before, but now the arrows continue on, advancing toward other islands she's never heard of, Iwo Jima, Okinawa, each flagged with the rising sun. The arrows converge from three directions on Japan, which is just a bunch of islands itself. As Tessie is getting the geography straight, the newsreel breaks into filmed footage. A hand cranks an alarm bell. Sailors jump out of bunks, double-time it up stairways, assuming battle stations. And then, there he is, Milton, running across the deck of the ship. Tessie recognizes his skinny chest, his raccoon eyes. She forgets about the floor and puts her feet down. In the newsreel, the destroyer's guns fire without sound, and half a world away, amid the elegance of an old-fashioned cinema, Tessie Zismo feels the recoils.
The theater is about half full, mostly with young women like her. They, too, are snacking on candies for emotional reasons. They, too, are searching the grainy newsreel for the faces of fiancés.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.
This is Audible.
The air smells of Tootsie Pops and perfume, and of the cigarette the usher is smoking in the lobby. Most of the time, the war is an abstract event, happening somewhere else. Only here, for 4 or 5 minutes, squeezed between the cartoon and the feature, does it become concrete. Maybe the blurring of identity, the mob release, has an effect on Tessie, inspiring the kind of hysteria Sinatra does. Whatever the reason, in the bedroom light of the movie theater, Tessie's Ismo allows herself to remember things she's been trying to forget. A clarinet nosing its way up her bare leg like an invading force itself, tracing an arrow to her own island empire, an empire which she realizes at that moment she's giving up to the wrong man. While the flickering beam of the movie projector slants through the darkness over her head, Tessie admits to herself that she doesn't want to marry Michael Antoniou. She doesn't want to be a priest's wife or move to Greece. As she gazes at Milton in the newsreel, her eyes fill with tears as she says out loud, "There was nowhere I could go that wouldn't be you." And while people shush her, the sailor in the newsreel approaches the camera, and Tessie realizes that it isn't Milton. It doesn't matter, however. She has seen what she has seen. She gets up to leave. On Hurlbut Street that same afternoon, Desdemona was lying in bed. She had been there for the last 3 days, ever since the mailman had delivered another letter from Milton. The letter wasn't in Greek, but English, and Lefty had to translate. "Dear folks, this is the last letter I'll be able to send you. Sorry for not writing in the native tongue, Ma, but I'm a little busy at the moment. The brass won't let me say much about what's going on, but I just wanted to drop you this note to tell you not to worry about me. I'm headed to a safe place. Keep the bar in good shape, Pop. This war'll be over some day, and I want in on the family business. Tell Zoe to stay out of my room. Love and laughs, Milt." Unlike the previous letters, this one arrived intact. Not a single hole anywhere. At first this had cheered Desdemona until she realized what it implied. There was no need for secrecy anymore. The invasion was already underway. At that point, Desdemona stood up from the kitchen table and, with a look of triumphant desolation, made a grave pronouncement. "God has brought the judgment down on us that we deserve," she said. She went into the living room, where she straightened a sofa cushion in passing and climbed the stairs to the bedroom. There she undressed and put on her nightgown, even though it was only 10 in the morning. And then, for the first time since being pregnant with Zoe, and the last time before climbing in forever 25 years later, my grandmother took to her bed. For 3 days she had stayed there, getting up only to go to the bathroom. My grandfather tried in vain to coax her out. When he left for work the third morning, he had brought up some food, a dish of white beans and tomato sauce and bread. The meal was still lying untouched on the bedside table when there came a knock at the front door. Desdemona did not get up to answer it, but only pulled a pillow over her face. Despite this muffling, she heard the knocking continue. A little later, the front door opened, and finally footsteps made their way up the stairs and into her room. "Aunt Des," Tessie said. Desdemona did not move. "I've got something to tell you," Tessie continued. "I wanted you to be the first to know." The figure in bed remained motionless. Still, the alertness that had seized Desdemona's body told Tessie she was awake and listening. Tessie took a breath and announced, "I'm going to call off the wedding." There was a silence. Slowly Desdemona pulled the pillow off her face. She reached for her glasses on the bedside table, put them on, and sat up in bed.
"You don't want to marry Mikey?"
"No."
"Mikey is a good Greek boy."
I know he is.
But I don't love him. I love Milton.
Tessie expected Desdemona to react with shock or outrage, but to her surprise, my grandmother barely seemed to register the confession.
You don't know this, but Milton asked me to marry him a while ago. I said no. Now I'm going to write him and say yes.
Desdemona gave a little shrug.
You can write what you want, honey moo. Milty, he won't get it.
It's not illegal or anything. First cousins can marry even. We're only second cousins. Milton went and looked up all the statutes.
Once again, Desdemona shrugged. Drained by worry, abandoned by St. Christopher, she stopped fighting an eventuality that had never been fated in the first place.
If you and Milty want to get married, you have my blessing, she said.
Then, having given her benediction, she settled back into her pillows and closed her eyes to the pain of living.
May God grant you never have a child who dies in the ocean.
In my family, the funeral meats have always furnished the wedding tables. My grandmother agreed to marry my grandfather because she never thought she'd live to see the wedding. And my grandmother blessed my parents' marriage after vigorously plotting against it, only because she didn't think Milton would survive to the end of the week. At sea, my father didn't think so either. Standing at the bow of the transport ship, he stared out over the water at his fast approaching end. He wasn't tempted to pray or to settle his accounts with God. He perceived the infinite before him, but didn't warm it up with human wishing. The infinite was as vast and cold as the ocean spreading around the ship, and in all that emptiness, what Milton felt most acutely was the reality of his own buzzing mind. Somewhere, out over the water, was the bullet that would end his life. Maybe it was already loaded in the Japanese gun from which it would be fired. Maybe it was in an ammunition roll. He was 21, oily skin prominent about the Adam's apple. It occurred to him that he had been stupid to run off to war because of a girl, but then he took this back because it wasn't just some girl. It was Theodora. As her face appeared in Milton's mind, a sailor tapped him on the back.
Who do you know in Washington?
He handed my father a transfer effective immediately. He was to report to the Naval Academy at Annapolis. On the admissions test, Milton had scored a 98. Every Greek drama needs a deus ex machina. Mine comes in the form of the bosun's chair that picked my father off the deck of the AKA transport ship and whisked him through the air to deposit him on the deck of a destroyer heading back to the U.S. mainland. From San Francisco, he traveled by elegant Pullman car to Annapolis, where he was enrolled as a cadet.
I tell you, St. Christopher gets you out of the war, Desdemona exulted when he called home with the news.
He sure did.
Now you have to fix the church.
What?
The church. You have to fix it.
Sure, Naval Cadet Stefanides said, and maybe he even intended to. He was grateful to be alive and to have his future back. But with one thing or another, Milton would put off his trip to Vithynios.
Within a year's time, he was married. Later, he was a father. The war ended. He graduated from Annapolis and served in the Korean War. Eventually, he returned to Detroit and went into the family business. From time to time, Desdemona would remind her son about his outstanding obligation to St. Christopher, but my father always found an excuse for not fulfilling it. His procrastination would have disastrous effects, if you believe in that sort of thing, which some days when the old Greek blood is running high...
I do.
My parents were married in June of 1946. In a show of generosity, Michael Antoniou attended the wedding. An ordained priest now, he presented a dignified, benevolent figure. But by the second hour of the reception, it was clear he was crushed. He drank too much champagne at dinner and, when the band began playing, sought out the next best thing to the bride, the bridesmaid, Zoe Stefanides. Zoe looked down at him, about a foot. He asked her to dance. The next thing she knew, they had started off across the ballroom floor. "Tessie told me a lot about you in her letters," said Michael Antoniou. "Nothing too bad, I hope." "Just the opposite. She told me what a good Christian you are." His long robe concealed his small feet, making it difficult for Zoe to follow. Nearby, Tessie was dancing with Milton in his white naval uniform. As the couples passed each other, Zoe glared comically at Tessie and mouthed the words, "I'm going to kill you." But then Milton twirled Tessie around, and the two rivals came face to face. "Hey there, Mike," said Milton cordially.
"It's Father Mike now," said the vanquished suitor.
"Ah, got a promotion, eh? Congratulations. I guess I can trust you with my sister." He danced away with Tessie, who looked back in silent apology. Zoe, who knew how infuriating her brother could be, felt sorry for Father Mike. She suggested they get some wedding cake. Ex ovo omnia. So to recap, Sormelina Zismo, nee Papa Diamandopoulos, wasn't only my first cousin twice removed, she was also my grandmother. My father was his own mother's and father's nephew. In addition to being my grandparents, Desdemona and Lefty were my great aunt and uncle. My parents would be my second cousins once removed, and Chapter 11 would be my third cousin as well as my brother. The Stephanides family tree, diagrammed in Dr. Luce's autosomal transmission of recessive traits, goes into more detail than I think you would care to know about. I've concentrated only on the gene's last few transmissions. And now we're almost there. In honor of Miss Berry, my eighth grade Latin teacher, I'd like to call attention to the quotation above, ex ovo omnia. Getting to my feet, as we did whenever Miss Berry entered the room, I hear her ask, "Infants, can any of you translate this little snippet and give its provenance?" I raise my hand. "Calliope, our muse, will start us off. It's from Ovid, Metamorphosis, the story of creation." "Stunning! And can you render it into English for us?" "Everything comes out of an egg." "Did you hear that, infants? This classroom, your bright faces, even dear old Cicero on my desk. They all came out of an egg." Among the arcana Dr. Philobosian imparted to the dinner table over the years, aside from the monstrous effects of maternal imagination, was the 17th century theory of preformation. The preformationists, with their roller coaster names, Spallanzini, Swammerdam, Leeuwenhoek, believed that all of humankind had existed in miniature since creation, in either the semen of Adam or the ovary of Eve, each person tucked inside the next like a Russian nesting doll. It all started when Jan Swammerdam used a scalpel to peel away the outer layers of a certain insect. What kind? Well, a member of the phylum Anthropoda. Latin name? Okay then, Bombyx mori. The insect Swammerdam used in his experiments back in 1650 was nothing other than a silkworm. Before an audience of intellectuals, Swammerdam cut away the skin of the silkworm to reveal what appeared to be a tiny model of the future moth inside, from proboscis to antennae to folded wings. The theory of preformation was born. In the same way, I like to imagine my brother and me floating together since the world's beginning on our raft of eggs, each inside a transparent membrane, each slotted for his or her, in my case both, hour of birth. There's Chapter 11, always so pasty and bald by the age of 23, so that he makes a perfect homunculus. His pronounced cranium indicates his future deftness with mathematics and mechanical things. His unhealthy pallor suggests his coming Crohn's disease. Right next to him, there's me, his sometime sister, my face already a conundrum, flashing like a lenticular decal between two images, the dark-eyed, pretty little girl I used to be, and the severe, aquiline-nosed, Roman coinish person I am today. And so we drifted, the two of us, since the world began, awaiting our cues and observing the passing show.
For instance, Milton Stephanides, graduating from Annapolis in 1949, his white hat flying up into the air. He and Tessie were stationed at Pearl Harbor, where they lived in austere marital housing, and where my mother, at 25, got a terrible sunburn and was never seen in a bathing suit again. In 1951, they were transferred to Norfolk, Virginia, at which point Chapter 11's egg sack next